listener, and welcome to a special edition of Big Mouth. I'm Andrew Harrison, and, like my Big Mouth colleague Matt Hall, I'm currently under a pile of Sprouts, Crackers and Quality Street right now. We are in no fit state to broadcast, so over the year we have prepared this one-off edition just to hold the fort. Everybody who loves music or movies or books has something that they love to hold on to, a keepsake, a collector's item, or a weird little knick-knack. So throughout the year we've been asking our guests which one item they would want to keep. Specifically, we said to them, if your flat went on fire, and of course, if all humans and animals were safe and sound, what's the one thing you'd want to rescue? So listen up and find out what some of Britain's best entertainment writers, plus Matt and me, would save from a conflagration. And don't leave those Christmas tree lights on overnight.
Hi, I'm Simon Reynolds, author of Shock and Awe, a book about glam rock, in shops right now. If my flat was on fire, I'm afraid to say I'd probably rescue all my old music papers I have in boxes. So I'd be going in and out, carrying box after box of Melody Makers, Enemies, Cream magazine, all this sort of treasury of rock writing from the 70s that actually informed the writing of Shock and Awe.
You do realise that having all these music papers in your flat is probably the reason that it's on fire. It is a fire hazard.
Highly combustible, yeah. Yeah, I'm done for. If anything, any spark goes near these music papers.
I kept all my Enemies from the 80s and was trying to move them out of my mum's house and discovered they'd been eaten by mice. And it was a heartbreaking sight because nothing ages like a cheapo newsprint from the 1970s. It goes papery.
They're a real health hazard. They just crumble. I probably should wear one of those sort of hazmat suits or
an alternate outfit.
Builder masks when I go in this room and do my research because they're lining my lungs.
When you say research, do you mean just getting lost for hours and hours and hours looking at old reviews of Blue Rondo a la Turk and things like that?
Yeah, and then just looking at the gig listing and the gossip page and the letters pages are fascinating. The things the readers are actually exercised about is quite fascinating.
Do you have any form of kind of Dewey Decimal system? Do you know when you think, oh yeah, there must be, let's go and look at Bolan interviews from the 70s?
If I'm lucky, I've put them in a sort of vague chronological order so that I can just kind of, you know, lift them all. They're terribly impractical things to have. My wife hates them. Yeah. Wish I would get rid of them.
But you would have thought that out there in the world, because you know, there are a lot of people with old stashes of music papers that, you know, people would just take on the task of digitizing one title or one year. You know, we sort of crowdsource it, do it between somebody's already done it with Select, which is quite nice because there's only about 100 issues to deal with. So you can digitize the lot. And there's a brilliant site out there where I can see all the terrible headlines I wrote and all the completely mistaken reviews where I got things completely wrong. But it's, you know, because there's a small enough amount, you can actually treat it as a corpus of work. I would love it if someone just said, okay, I'm going to do NME 1982. I'm going to do Melody Maker 1987.
Supposedly whoever owns IPC is planning to do that with Melody Maker and Enemy, but the thing was that, you know, they're just so much material and there's like page on a page of musicians' ads and stuff, and they're all in this fragile state, so it would be a real undertaking to do it. But someone should, though.
The paradox is, if a company's doing it, then they have to put revenue streams next to it. They have to invest, they have to pay somebody, and that's the reason it never happens. I've seen many large publishing companies do a big copyright grab. We own the stuff, we're going to do something with it. Never happens, they never do it. But if it's down to a person with a pile of magazines in their bedroom and a scanner, it'll happen because it'll become their private obsession.
Yeah.
So I think our call from Big Mouth out there is somebody take this task on for the good of people like Simon, so his house is burned down, and his wife.
My name's Hannah Verdier, freelance TV and radio writer. If my flat was on fire, I would go up into the loft and I would save my music magazine collection. Mm. I first came to music magazines when I became obsessed with Smash Hits, which I later worked on, purely because of my love of the Pet Shop Boys and Five Star. I still have all those covers, and later it was Select and Q. And I remember Select in a box so clearly. All the toys you got in there.
Yeah, it You'll was blow up Keith Flint.
Yes, the great annual event.
Yes.
And also my beloved Qs from the days when Tom Hibbert used to do the interviews, and he's my all-time favourite writer and hero.
Yeah.
And I just love them so much. I know I could probably find them online somewhere, but not in their entirety. They're just still so special. And I worry that my kids will grow up not knowing what magazines are as well.
I think it's quite a good idea to get rid of the music magazines if you have flats on fire, because they are the most flammable thing.
Yes.
In fact, they are, in fact, a fire hazard.
I know.
You've got to get rid of them before that
however,
flat goes on fire.
However, they do weigh a ton.
Yes.
Yes.
I know this because when I moved house, I took them from one loft to the other without even looking at them, but I just couldn't throw them out. Mm. And everyone's like, why are you hoarding those? just because I am.
Well, it's reference materials. It's very, very important. You need them for research.
Although it's quite... when I moved from one place in London to another, I had all the old faces. Mm. And I just thought, you know what, this is ridiculous, lugging these around and not having opened them for ages. And I actually kind of went to St Martin's School of Art, or Cordwainers, because I lived in Hackney at the time, and said to them, would you like this selection of, you know, the faces going back? Kind of, and they went, no. They said, no, we've got too many of those already.
So every single face reader has been donating their face to the
currency is... So magazines that maybe weren't so omnipresent might have more of a kind of cultural... value or even a monetary value. But
there's a really nice website where somebody has scanned full issues of Select and full covers and done a little commentary on them as well, which is really nice to me. I'm editing the thing, you can just go back and go, my God, did we really say that?
Do you know what, as well, he does requests, because I couldn't find an article, I couldn't find something that I'd written for Select, and I couldn't even remember when it was or what, you know, and I got in touch with him and said, have you got this issue and would you be able to find this out? And he scanned it for me and put it up. So, yeah.
Hannah, all that heavy stuff, your flat's on fire. You've got tons and tons to move. If you can only get one issue out, if you only got time, which issue is it going to be?
Oh, it would actually be the Smash Hits with the Pet Shop Boys on the cover and they're wearing sailor hats and costumes. Because also it has an interview with Michael Hutchins in and a full page poster. Those were the days.
Have you kept the posters in?
Yes, I did actually, most of them.
Wow.
But then I think some of the New Order ones I've taken out and they only recently came down off my wall because I thought I'm a bit old to have a Barney poster on my wall. Or am I? Who knows?
Is the cover line Hello Sailors or Nautical But Nice?
It certainly should be. There's definitely an Ahoy in there. Pet Shop Ahoys.
I'm Nicholas Pegg, I'm a Dalek in Doctor Who, and I'm the author of The Complete David Bowie, and I do various other things as well. And if my house was on fire, it would be about The Complete David Bowie, I'm afraid, because one of the lovely things is that David Bowie himself did me the great honour of being very kind and supportive of the book over the years, and every time a new edition came out, we would send some copies over to his offices in New York, and he would always write something very kind and nice in one of them and send it back to me. And so I have a little box with those in, and that's what I'd have to save.
Oh, right. What kind of things did he write?
Well, my favourite one, which I've actually quoted in the new, right at the end of the new edition, because I thought I really just wanted to pop that in.
Yeah.
He would write warm, funny, lovely things. My favourite one from a couple of editions ago, he wrote, Nick, this is an amazing job. And hang on, let me get this right. Mm-hmm. You can edit this.
No, the ruffling of pages will give it verisimilitude.
I'm ruffling pages because I don't want to misquote this. Okay, here's what he wrote. Nick, an amazing job, but of course it's all wrong. He put a little smiley there. Bless his heart.
My name's Sean Pappenden, and if my flat was in the fire, I think I would take my beautiful autograph from Gilbert and George with me that says, to dear Sean, whether they knew I was dear or not, I was very, very drunk. To dear Sean, with lots of love, Gilbert and George. And George wrote it, and Gilbert just put the Gilbert bit in. I got it when I met them at a Korean restaurant that doesn't exist anymore in Highbury. I was with one of the UK's foremost feminists at the time, and we were slaughtered. We were so drunk. I can't remember why we were so drunk, but I think we were in the restaurant sort of trying to sober up by eating some food that we probably didn't eat anyway. Mm. There's Gilbert and George in the corner. What was weirder is that they had been presented with this Korean sort of sculpture of fruit that was incredibly lewd. And we couldn't work out. It had lots of, you know, carrots and sort of strangely shaped vegetables and things that had been sculpted. It was really bizarre. And we just thought, we were so excited, And we just went up and chatted to them and they were lovely. I would take that.
Didn't they used to go to that Korean restaurant every day at the same time?
No, they go to a Turkish restaurant in Stoke Newton every day at the same time.
Yeah, but I think that's because that Korean restaurant is no longer
there. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Did they get a lewd... Do you reckon they got a lewd?
I think they probably got it every day. I thought there's a cafe they go to in Bloomsbury. I thought they go there every day.
Mm-hmm. Well, they used to go to the cafe, which is obviously no longer there anymore, on the corner of the street that they live.
Yeah. Fournier Street.
Yeah. There was an old cafe there that was there for like 40 years, and that they used to go there, and it's now a pop-up Japanese denim
store. And they were always in the phone book. They believed that, you know,
they could be listed in the phone book, so you could ring them up at Fournier Street if you wanted to and have a chat. I mean, they really liked them. They were such lovely people. We couldn't hardly stand. We were so drunk, and they were still nice to us.
I like the idea that the Gilbert and George fruit platter was just on the menu at this thing. Bulbous phallic fruit.
It was really bizarre. And maybe if they did go every week or every day, they just kept being presented with the lewd platter.
But of course, one of their famous kind of early works is that film of them just drinking gin and getting really, really sloshed. Yeah. So maybe they saw Kindred Spirits and thought that you and the internationally renowned feminist were recreating
part
their
of
artwork.
The gang.
I also like the idea that in 50 years' time, that sort of cock and balls fruit arrangement will still be on the menu.
Yeah.
The origins of the name will have been lost in the mists of time somewhere, and one of those sort of strange oddities you see on a Chinese restaurant menu. And I'm like, why is cock and balls fruit on the menu? And well, like, don't know. It just has been since about 1999.
Yeah. It's one way of getting you five a day.
Bit of Stan Boardman there at the end.
My name's Kate Mossman. I'm the arts editor of The New Statesman. And if my flat went on fire, I would save a recent acquisition, which is a cartoon of the notable piano player Bruce Hornsby, drawn for me and for The New Statesman by the American cartoonist Tony Millionaire. So he did National Ransom for Elvis Costello. He's appeared in The New Yorker. So I decided to go and interview Bruce Hornsby in Virginia because I think he's fascinating and nobody had told his story. And I thought, nobody really knows what he looks like. I don't want to use a 1986 picture because it'll look like a retrospective piece. So let's get Tony to draw him. Tony had done various Grateful Dead covers and Bruce Hornsby was in the Grateful Dead. So I write to him and he said, oh, yes, absolutely, I'd love to do this. The days go by, the weeks go by. It's Tuesday morning. We're going to press in an hour and he still hasn't sent the picture of Bruce Hornsby. He said, what kind of thing do you want? And I said, well, I don't know. This is a man.
What, with an hour to go? He said, what kind of thing do you want?
The night before, he said, what kind of thing do you want? Oh, God, this is a disaster. We had a whole page set aside for it. And I said, well, I don't know. This is a musical maverick carving his way out into increasingly odd waters or something like that. And literally half an hour before we went to press, this picture turns up and it's Bruce Hornsby, as he is now, 62, sitting at a piano, sailing it across the seas.
Wow.
With a load of little notes, like seagulls, flapping around his head. And he's sort of grinning down the barrel of the camera. We ran it, and Tony Millionaire sent it to me for free afterwards, and I've got that framed above my own piano.
He's great, Tony Millionaire.
He's really good.
I met him when I worked in New York 20 years ago on Details magazine. He used to have a fantastic strip called Drunky Crow. And it was just about a crow that got drunk and got into trouble. And he's got this amazing sort of 1930s style to his art, hasn't he? It's a little bit Will Eisner-y, a little bit kind of 1930s newspaper strip.
Yes, and he looks the part as well. Yeah. So I think he's called like Tony Johnson or something like that. But he called himself Millionaire and he's sucking on a cigar. He looks really beaten up in all his photos. He's really great. We want to use him again, but it was pretty hairy. So we'll have to be careful about the deadlines.
Just give him a fake deadline.
Give him a fake deadline.
Yes. Hello, I'm Andrew Harrison, and I'm the presenter of Big Mouth. And if my flat went on fire, the item that I would rescue would be a piece of original Judge Dredd artwork from 1977 that I got on eBay. And I remember reading it when it came out. It's a single page of Judge Dredd, and it's the first time that he meets a character called Max Normal, the pinstripe freak. And the conceit of it is that Judge Dredd is a policeman in the future city of Mega City 1, and everybody's weird. Everybody wears knee pads and has insane hair, and there are mutants and robots and everything. And Max Normal is the only guy in the city who dresses in the style of a 1970s city gent. He wears a pinstripe suit and a bowler hat, and he's got a moustache, and he carries an umbrella. And he's Judge Dredd's informant, and he says things like, don't be mean to the dude who's clean. And Dredd says things to him like, you make me sick, why can't you be weird like a normal person? And it's this beautiful full page drawn by the great Mike McMahon, who was one of the absolute formative Judge Dredd artists. He's the guy who gave everybody huge feet and huge knee pads and really kind of scratchy and bizarre and impressionistic and weird. He was the kind of the opposite of Brian Bolland, who for whom everything was kind of photorealistic and beautifully lined.
Where do you think he stands with the kind of Carlos Esquerra?
Well, Esquerra was kind of he originally designed Dredd, and then there was a bit of a row because McMahon got to draw Dredd first and Esquerra went off in a huff and didn't come back for years.
Because Esquerra's style is very kind of scratchy, spaghetti western.
So McMahon is like that. McMahon is kind of, it's very European. It's not the American beautiful, clean, like, you know, John Buscema in American comics, or, you know, where it's all, you know, as photorealist as it can possibly be made. It's the opposite. It is a mad, mad vision. Like my other favourite artist, Kevin O'Neill, who used to draw Nemesis
ABC
the Warlock.
ABC
Warriors. Yeah, Nemesis the Warlock. McMahon drew ABC Warriors as well. So this page, and I got it on eBay, and I thought, you know, I think it was about 600 quid or something like that. And I'm looking at it thinking, that's quite a lot of money to pay for something that I think I paid 10p for originally. Don't think even I paid for it. I think my brother Ian paid for it. 10p or 8p earth money as it was. And then I just looked at it and thought, well, I'm never going to get a chance to own this ever again. So I bid on it and I bought it. And I had to go down to some bizarre place down in Surrey to a weird house where a weird gentleman lived with loads of old, you know, mannequins and bits of special effects ephemera, and hurried out with it in a roll. And now it's on the wall. And every time I come out of the bathroom in the morning, having brushed my teeth, I can see Mega City 1 in 1977 and Max Normal.
And I'm assuming it's black and white.
Oh, yeah.
Black.
And the great thing about it is you can see all the little additions of, you know, liquid paper, and you can see where the lettering's been stuck down and where pencil has been erased and where the inker hasn't quite... I think McMahon inked his own stuff. I think that he hasn't quite inked his pencil the way he wanted to, or he's improved it in the inking. Or you can see all the craft there. Plus, around the edge, you can see written in pencil, 2000 AD, March 1979. All this stuff. It's just endlessly beautiful to look at.
I'm Dorian Linsky. I write for The Guardian and many other publications. And if my house was on fire, I would rescue something that's actually only been in the house for about 3 months. I never really asked for autographs. But when I interviewed Paul and Ringo from The Beatles over the summer, I had bought a book, a sort of songbook for my daughter, Eleanor, and I mentioned to Paul at the end, and I said, oh, my daughter is named after, partly named after Eleanor Rigby, at which Ringo, as I predicted, went, you called her Rigby.
and that's then, so Ringo.
Which was proper classic Ringo. And... and then he signed it to her, to Eleanor, double exclamation mark, love Paul McCartney.
Ah.
And it's just an irreplaceable thing that is both a cool thing, because it's one of the Beatles, and a thing about my daughter and the fact that she's learning to play guitar and she's learning to play Beatles songs.
It's very nice. There's a tale, the great Mark Ellen, great magazine editor, founder of Q and Mojo and kind of mentor to me and a lot of other people, told a tale about when he interviewed Macca for the first edition of Q. And he, you know, said at the end of the interview, will you just please just sign this? And Paul goes, yes, signs the album, the copy of the White Album. And then Macca goes, do you want the other ones as well? And Mark goes, what? Do you want the other Beatles signatures? We can all do each other's signatures, you know. Quickly signs it. Ringo, George, and John, who was dead. There you go. Signed by the Beatles. Here you go, Mark. So they, because obviously in the 60s, they had to sign an awful lot of stuff.
Yeah.
They had to learn it very, very quickly. Possibly an apocryphal tale, but never mind. Mark Ellen.
Justin Quirk, I'm the editor of Supplement, the art magazine, and were my flat to go up in flames tonight, the first thing I'd grab for would be a sort of slightly squalid laundry bag full of ancient reggae records, which I recently found in a charity shop while scuffling through all the old copies of Diamond Life by Sade and Brothers in Arms, and stumbled across this, basically the motherload of reggae records from sort of 1971 to 1988, which I suspect had come from a house clearance or maybe someone had passed away. But I feel like it was sort of cosmic payback for years and years and years of scuffling through these sort of old, dusty, sort of terrible records and copies of James Last, Hooked on Classics, and eventually striking gold. But I haven't had a chance to work through them yet, so I don't know what treasure lurks in the bag.
What kind of roughly is there? What sort of...
It's astonishing. It's there's a label called Wackies, which was a reasonably obscure Jamaican label based in New York that Horace Andy started on, and whoever put this collection together was obviously very, very into Wackies. They had quite a unique sound. So there's a bunch of sort of odd 10 inches and 12 inches from there. There's a lot of early original sort of John Holt and Horace Andy first pressings, tons of King Tubby Studio One albums, odd kind of Lee Perry things that I've never seen before. It was basically, if you had even a passing interest in Jamaican music, it was the most astonishing find.
So this is basically the instant Jar Quirk DJ set?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, it was...
Straight out of Kingston.
Yes. I'm not sure Kingston is actually ready for it. Yeah. Maybe Too Dread.
Yes, Too Dread for Kingston would be a great name for a mix.
And it also brings up the possibility that had these all been shipped inadvertently to an address in Kingston upon Thames, intended for Kingston.
There's some bloke in Orange Street going, "Where's my record?"
Yeah. Why has someone sent me a box full of Level 42? Yeah.
Why is this a car dome delivery turned up at my in my yard, back a yard?
In like Firehouse or
yeah,
whatever.
It's, all the blueberries have gone off.
It's an intriguing possibility, because I can't think of any other reason why they'd have ended up there, because Kingston, particularly at that time when I was growing up there, was more renowned for sort of derelict shopping precincts and huge roving mobs of unpleasant skinheads rather than anything particularly ITAL. So, who knows? Yeah.
Well, you're bringing Kingston back to its roots.
I like to think so.
Excellent.
Just the man to do it.
Hello, I'm Michael Han. I'm the music editor of The Guardian, and the one thing I would save if my flat was on fire would be my 5 copies of the second Ramones album, Leave Home, which were assembled lovingly through my teens, 20s, 30s, and indeed 40s, as different editions came out. It's especially the 2 versions on vinyl with Carbona, not glue, that mean the most to me, because in the days when you couldn't just find everything online, finding a copy of Ramones Leave Home with Carbona, not glue on was something akin to finding an untapped seam of gold in the Yukon. I can vividly remember the day in June 1986 when I got my first copy, £3 from Revolution Records in Windsor, and it will stay with me forever.
If we were to blindfold you and play a specific edition, would you be able to identify it?
No.
Oh. I don't think it's all vinyl, or there's some hated CDs and things like that, and cassettes or anything like that.
I beg your pardon, sorry?
It's all vinyl then, you haven't got any
CDs? No, I have 3 on vinyl, 2 on CD. I'm currently pondering whether to get the deluxe edition of the first Ramones album, because I only have 4 copies of the first Ramones album currently.
Right. So it's quite deficient, really, there.
I am quite sure. Quite short in that area.
It's interesting, isn't it? The Ramones have become... My son is 8 years old and he's learning to play the drums and has lessons at school. And his summer holiday kind of task is to learn to play the drums to Sheena Is a Punk Rocker.
That's going to take all summer.
Well, it's just fantastic. It's an excuse to drive round, as we were doing yesterday, playing like the Ramones' greatest hits in the car.
Michael, do you go and shout at people in the street if they're wearing Ramones T-shirts and ask them to identify their favourite track?
No, I don't. I think that's it's a bit spurious doing that, isn't it, really? I feel a bit sad that you could go into British Home Stores while it still existed and buy large quantities of Ramones T-shirts when you couldn't do that when the Ramones were actually alive and in position to benefit from the money that would come in from them. But I don't shout at people wearing T-shirts. The only T-shirt thing I've ever really been irritated about was David Beckham wearing his Diamante studded Crass logo T-shirt sometime in the late 90s and thinking,
has it come to this?
It's not that you haven't heard of Crass. I don't care about that. It's just that Diamante studded high fashion thing, it's kind of the exact opposite of what Crass are about.
My wife's got a fantastic Mitford's T-shirt, and it's based on the Ramones logo. It just says Mitford's, and it says Diana, Devo, whatever. And I think in the middle it says you, non-you. She'd be proud of it.
Hello, my name's Andrew Perry. I'm a freelance writer for Q Mojo and the Daily Telegraph. The thing I would rescue from my house if it were on fire would be my box of vintage reggae 7-inches from the 1960s and 70s. It has taken me most of my life to put these bloody things together. Right. And that's the one thing I couldn't see go up in flames.
So what are the jewels in there, in Jar Perry's... Arc.
Well, the things that are tough to get hold of are, you know, vintage Upsetter records from Jamaica on Lee Scratch Perry's own label, which are often adorned with words like disco bum. These are, believe me, hard to find.
Right.
But there's also sort of old Island and Blue Beat and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And just playing them, they bring so much pleasure. Sometimes I think, why did I pay £30 for this thing? Mm. But actually, when you put it on, it is actually worth £30.
Yeah.
It's something that is, the value has escalated because it is actually worth owning, you know?
Yeah.
And it sounds better than ever an MP3 or even a CD would.
You know?
There's just something about the authenticity of it, and the actual sound is great.
That's why the young folk like their vinyls now, isn't it?
They love their vinyls. Well, yeah, well, I love my vinyls too.
Well, David, the great David Rodigan owns so many of these things, he's had to reinforce the floor of his house, hasn't he? Wow. He's an enormous reggae collection. He's put actual joists and girders in to stop him being buried under a pile of ruticleness.
I actually had to do the same thing.
Really? What, you've had to reinforce your floor?
Yeah.
Death by pre-release 7.
So we had all the shelves down. Yeah. I was having some building work done. And he said, are you going to put all this back up here? He said, we need to just put a few bricks under each floorboard. I actually had to do the same thing.
So the answer to what would happen if your house went on fire is nothing, because it's made of steel girders rocket fuel can't burn reggae 7 inches, etc.
And actually one thing that did happen, I used to have a recurring dream. That I got back from holiday, and when I turned round the corner, the whole side of the house had fallen down. Right. And all my records were in the road, and people were running off with bagfuls of classic.
Some people think that's a psychological metaphor, but I think what it's showing is you have a deep fear of people stealing your records, basically.
I think just stick it all on iPod and don't have the worry, probably.
Don't do that.
No, that's wrong.
Hello, I'm Joel Morris. I'm a comedy writer. I write with Charlie Brooker, amongst others, and I co-created the Lady Bird Books for Grown-Ups series. If my flat was on fire, I would rescue a Frank Hampson painting of Peter Pumpkin Eater that came from the Lady Bird Book of Nursery Rhymes I had as a child. And it was the first thing I bought when we got paid our advance for doing the Lady Bird Books. I thought I should own a piece of Lady Bird art. I'd always wanted one. And it's tiny, which I find fascinating. These people could paint with tiny brushes. I think they get the feeling that commercial artists back then were paid just enough to not waste any Bristol board. The skill with which he's painted this tiny image, and it's a slightly haunting image of a man who's locked his wife in a pumpkin. and it's also one of the few things now in our cloud-based society that would definitely be lost if my house caught fire, because everything else is backed up apart from my child and wife.
And this is the great Frank Hampson who drew and painted Dan Dare.
Yes, so it's the great thing about Frank Hampson doing nursery rhymes, I find, is that he worked from photographs a lot. So they look like documentary pictures of nursery rhymes actually happening. And also he's sort of struggling a bit to put the fantasy elements in with the real people. And you do wonder whether it's haunting to make it look realistic. If Quentin Blake did it, there'd be a safety of you going, this is a fantasy. But actually, because it looks photorealistic, it stays with you from your childhood.
Did his Dan Dare work come before or after?
Yeah, he was doing Dan Dare before that. This is done in the mid-60s.
Oh.
Yeah.
Hold on, you had to go out and buy it. You're the man who, with your partner, single-handedly resuscitated the Ladybird brand, and you're not allowed the keys to the castle. Just if you want to decorate your bathroom with Ladybird pictures, go ahead.
It's all precious and expensive, and it's in an archive somewhere. It's kept. The Ladybird archive was going to be burned.
What?
Slightly before we turned up, it was going to be binned. They didn't have room to store it, and it was going to be put in a skip. And a very lady with a lot of foresight called Ronnie Fairweather, who runs Ladybird, said, we're going to save it, found a university to look after it, and scanned it all in, which is how we managed to do the books. But the artwork, this piece of artwork I bought off Frank Hampson's son, who was auctioning it off. If you go to his website, something Hampson, he auctions off his dad's artwork to sort of help the family.
Has he got any Dan Dare?
Yeah, there's Dan Dare there. There's all his sort of look and learn stuff. It's great.
Triton as well.
Trigon Empire.
Yeah. That might be it. Yeah, honestly, search for Frank Hampson's art. It's for sale. It's not as expensive as you'd think as well. It's really nice. A lot of this stuff, a lot of the Ladybird stuff, the John Berry and stuff, goes for thousands and thousands. But the Frank Hampson stuff's all quite affordable. But I really wanted it. I grew up with those books. And the thing about Ladybird is that it's the colours. Everyone remembers the magic porridge pot's purple and the red and the yellow and the green, the elves and the shoemaker's shoes and Cinderella's dresses. But to have those colours not even reproduced, just the original ones, it's quite Proustian. It takes you back. You feel like a little kid. It's a bit of a magic picture. So I'd save that because there's only one of those.
Hello, my name's James Med. I'm a freelance writer. If my flat was on fire, I would save my Bob Dylan print. Which is signed by the man himself, has been in his presence,
ooh,
has been touched by his hand.
What is it actually a print of? Is it a photograph?
It's a picture called Lady at the Lion Door, and right. It's a picture of a woman from behind.
Oh, is it one of his paintings? One of his prints?
Yes, yeah. But it's a print. I think it's been... I'm not sure it's got much to do with him.
So did you buy it signed, or did you...
Yes.
Okay, no, right.
I've never met him.
No, well, you never know. You might have a friend who's going in, you know, kind of thing. Is it framed?
Oh, yes.
Where is it sitting?
Oh, it's in my bedroom.
Is it? Right. So you, in the morning, you wake up and you think about Bob Dylan. That, yeah. Last thing at night.
And can I ask a question? If it didn't have a signature from Bob Dylan on it, would you give it house room?
Oh, yeah, because I know it's by him.
Oh, right.
Oh, what? Purely on aesthetic grounds?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know a lot about art, but I know what I like.
Hi, my name's Joe Muggs. I am mostly a freelance journalist, and I DJ, and I put on events from time to time. If my house was on fire, I would immediately want to save some records, and then I would die in the fire trying to choose which ones. But records aside, I would save my Pete Fowler portrait of Prince, which I had framed in a purple frame.
Wow, purple frame. So Pete Fowler is, of course, the Super Furry Animals artiste in residence. Where did you get this from?
Shortly after Prince died, the guys at Spiritland, the hyper expensive ultra hi-fi venue, did a Prince tribute night with loads of DJs, like Hot Chip and Bill Brewster, and people played Prince and Prince related obscurities and stuff. And Pete Fowler, being friends of that whole circle, did the flyer for it, and they did 20 Prince of Prince.
Someday my prince will come.
Exactly. As the Happy Snaps lady said.
If you want to, baby, here I am. Come on.
Hello, my name's Eamon Forward. I am a freelance music business journalist and full-time idiot. And if my flat was on fire, the thing that I would save is a signed picture of Maggie Jones, who is the sadly departed actress who played the glorious Blanche in Coronation Street, who is my greatest hero. A friend had got a signed copy off eBay and gave it to me. And middle class alert, the other week, my cleaner was in, because I'm very lazy and not very good at cleaning, and she pointed to the picture of Blanche signed and said, "Is that your mother?" I didn't know how to explain that one, but that's because...
she said, yes, my spiritual mother.
Yeah. Yes, if you look on Twitter, that sees my picture on Twitter, because I love Blanche so much.
Do you love Blanche so much? Why is she your heroine?
Because she is... She kind of voices every evil thought that you have about idiots getting in your way and blocking your life, and she says them, and she's so cutting and camp. And it's all the stuff that you that's great about Coronation Street, the kind of the camp northern humour, the archness, really strong female characters, and she's the absolute embodiment of that.
What's your favourite Blanche bit?
Oh, there's so many. There was an incident in the street, and I think David Platt had gone mad and started smashing things up with a golf club, and they retire into the Rovers. And I can't remember who it was, a character offers to buy her a drink to calm her down, and she said, oh, thanks very much, I'll just have a double. I love her.
Okay, my name's Johnny Davis, and I'm the deputy editor of Esquire magazine. And if my flat was on fire, the thing that I would save is one of the first things I was asked to do in journalism, which was to write to Stephen Hawking and ask if there was a formula for time travel. And this was pre-email, it was 1995, and so we faxed Stephen Hawking and said, do you have a formula for time travel? And he actually faxed back, and I still have the fax that explained that there wasn't, but he was working very hard towards procuring such a thing, and that's it.
Wow. So did he give you a further explication on that, where we might possibly get towards time travel?
He didn't. He just wrote back a little paragraph. But it's just nice because it's on fax paper and it comes from him. It's a cool thing.
Who was it for?
It was for the Face magazine. It was my first. I think I was on work experience and I was tasked with, yes.
One of the first things I had to do was set up an interview with Hunter S. Thompson and faxed him in Woody Creek. And he faxed back, but the BBC fax machine had that horrible kind of ISIL-type paper.
Right.
And it was like... on a proper gonzo-headed paper with kind of HST written on it.
Right.
It was absolutely fantastic. And then kind of 2 weeks later, we noticed it was starting to kind of disappear and fade and change, and it just vanished.
Oh no!
And it was like no,
like vanishing ink.
Yeah.
God, you need to.
No, this is on. This is on. I think this is proper. No, last time I looked, it was. You know, yeah. I mean, it's been 20 years, so I think it's. I think we're okay.
Excellent.
I'm Simon Price, and I am a hoarder and a collector of pop memorabilia. Obviously records, but you can't rescue your record collection because it's too big and too heavy. So I think the one thing I would save that I'm really proud of, I own a couple of the actual washing powder boxes from the Pulp Common People video. What happened was when they brought out the album, A Different Class, they had a launch party at St. Martin's College, as in, you know, as in lyric from the song. And they'd somehow rescued a pyramid, a massive pile of these purple, yellow and pink pulp washing powder boxes. You know, you see Jarvis in a massive shopping trolley being pushed down the supermarket aisle. And at the end of the night, I just thought, well, you know, what's going to happen to them? They're just going to get trashed. I'm having a couple of them. And they've survived now various house moves, you know, and, you know, relationship breakups and all kinds of stuff. I'm keeping those boxes. They, you know, that's my favourite bit of pop memorabilia I own.
That's a classic piece of a pop relic. I managed to, from a party, pinch a conical Pet Shop Boys hat, you know, one of the red and white spirally ones. And it's up at my mum somewhere, but it's an actual Pet Shop
Boys. I think you win. If I owned that, I'd be broadcasting that the whole time.
You should wear it on the chin.
She came from Greece, she had a thirst for knowledge. She studied sculpture at St. Martin's College, that's where I.
My name's Luke Turner. I'm the editor of The Quietus and write about various things for various people. And if my flat were on fire, I would rescue a painting that my granny did, because she left school when she was 14. All she ever really wanted was to be an art teacher, and she couldn't do it. She had to go and be a dinner lady and a typist. And I've got a picture she did later in life of a barn. Just a simple picture, a watercolour. And if my flat was on fire, I'd take that off the wall. And I'd actually also put on a leather jacket my dad gave me that he bought with his first paycheck in 1968. Very nice jacket, a bit like a Marquis Smith sort of leather jacket. And I'd put my painting under my wall and I'd leave and it would all collapse behind me. And I'd be quite happy I'd rescued those things.
Would you walk away from your flat in slow motion in your leather jacket with your painting on your arm while it collapsed cinematically in the background?
Absolutely.
And you became a kind of, you know, you walked away with the only things a man needs in life. A nice jacket and art.
Exactly. And I'd go and I'd sit under a tree, fix the picture to the tree, and sit back against it, my leather jacket, watch the embers. Be
you are
content.
You are fundamentally Jack Kerouac, then, aren't you? Really, basically.
Oh no!
Sorry, you've said it now.
My name's Miranda Sawyer. I am a journalist, and if my flat was on fire, I don't know how we'd get out because we don't really have a fire escape. But let's not think about that. I would grab a picture that my son drew when he was 5, and my daughter was about to arrive. I was very pregnant, and he drew a picture of them in bunk beds, even though he'd never met them and never met her. And it was very, very sweet in that 5-year-old way. And I have it framed, and I would take that.
And has he, in the subsequent years, has he attempted to smash it?
I've actually hidden it. He's really regretting it. She's still there and is under the bunk beds and he doesn't like her anymore, but that's life.
Hello, I'm Jude Rogers. I'm a journalist for The Observer and The Guardian and Music Mags. And if my flat was on fire, the thing I would save would be my framed copy of Songs of Love and Hate by Len Cohen, because it was one of the first records my mum and dad bought together when they got together. And I came across when I was about 12 or 13 in their record collection and started playing. And I was like, who is this strange man? And I love him. And basically fell in love with Leonard Cohen from there, and only much later found out the significance of it in my life and in my parents' life. And so that, it's sentimental reasons, because it's a great record. That's why I'd save it.
Yeah, and it changed the way you thought about your mum and dad and the way they thought about music. Because your dad died when you were quite young.
Yeah, he did. And my mum, my dad, basically his music taste, from the taped cassettes from the early 80s that I found around the house, had quite similar music taste to me. He liked a lot of cheesy disco as well as slight early synth pop and stuff like that. But liked, you know, the Beatles and Stones and old classics like that. Whereas my mum, when I was a child, didn't really play. She played a tape she'd got from vouchers off the Daily Mirror, which was the best in 1963. She played that in the car all the time, which was good. And she'd play tapes of Welsh hymns and Ralph McTell, and that was basically it. And then to find out that my mum actually really loved Leonard Cohen, because, you know, I just used to run off with records from the house and not really think about it. You know, say, I'm taking this to university with me, I'm taking these up to London with me. When I did that, with that record, she said, oh, I have to tell you about this record. And so that was really nice.
Is the album still inside it, or have you got it? Have you kept it out for playing?
No, the album is not inside. It's in its, you know, original paper sleeve, in a one of those thick plastic sleeves that really smell heavily. You never get those sleeves anymore. That is preserved. It's got a slight scratch in it that predated me. And the cover is, you know, it's a bit worn. It's definitely not in mint condition. It's probably not VG. But it's a fantastic cover, and it's just very stark and it's very beautiful. And it's on the wall next to a Delia Derbyshire record.
Ooh, shrine.
Which is, yeah, which is very my thing. But Delia Derbyshire and Leonard Cohen, what a party.
Christmassy as that, does it? That was Avalanche by Laughing Leonard Cohen from the album Songs of Love and Hate, closely connected to Jude Rogers' choice of item there. Thanks for listening to this special edition of Big Mouth, where people have shared their most prized possessions with us. We'll be back in January with a regular show where we will be, as usual, talking about the most interesting stuff in pop culture, music, film, telly, and all the rest of it. In the meantime, enjoy Christmas, and we will see you in 2017.